I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Joanna Hamilton. She's director and producer of the film 1971. It opens this Friday at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a documentary about a citizen break-in to an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia, in 1971, a break-in in which the burglars were never caught. Now the people who did it have gone public. You made a documentary about it. How did you find these people, this story?
I consider myself very fortunate to have known Betty Metzger, who back in the day was the reporter at the Washington Post that they sent the documents to. Once they had broken in and taken the documents, they sent them to the press. And the long story short, which I hope your viewers will come and see the film, obviously, the Washington Post was the only newspaper that published stories about the documents. Certainly, they published the initial stories. Once they'd broken the news, you know, many, many, many newspapers followed suit and wrote stories that, for the first time, were critical of J. Edgar Hoover. So Betty and I knew each other for years and years, and, over the course of time, Betty was writing a book. That book came out last year. It's called The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. And as I say, I had the great good fortune to know her as a personal friend before we collaborated. I would say to her periodically over time, you know, when you're ready to make the film, please let me know. And there came a point, it's now about 5 years ago, where she called me up and she said, you know, are you serious? And I said, yes, of course. At that point in time, then back in 1971, they had been anonymous sources to her. And then about 20 years later, two of them revealed themselves to her almost accidentally. And that's how she found the group and began her research.
Set the stage for us. What led these young people, or mostly young people, to break into the FBI office?
The group as a whole were all involved with anti-war activities, protesting the Vietnam War at the time. They were all very, you know, politically engaged, as were so many people back then. And so that was really the sort of thing that brought them, you know, that held them together. But this was different. I mean, it was one thing to protest the war and to break into draft board offices, but the way I viewed it was sort of, they kind of did this right angle turn. Bill Davidon, who was the leader of the group, who was a professor at Haverford, everybody speaks about this sort of pervasive sense of paranoia that people were feeling within the protest movement. You know, were there FBI informants in their midst? Were they being spied on? Was the government trying to stop them from expressing, their opposing views? And it was on that basis, you know, Bill thought, you know, that if the government was trying to suppress dissent, then that was as important to expose that as it was to protest the war in Vietnam. And so it was on that basis that they decided to go through with this very dramatic action. So as I say, it was, you know, draft board raids were, you know, relatively common back then. Burglarizing an FBI office obviously was not. And they viewed it as a last resort. It wasn't something that they wanted to do, but they surmised that it was probably unlikely that J. Edgar Hoover, who was really all powerful at the time, he was sort of the de facto kind of shadow president, that no one in Washington was going to really call him to account, and nobody was ever going to really be able to discover what was going on. And so it was on that basis that they decided to take this dramatic action. But, yeah, they were academics, students, social workers. They ran a range of different professional activities back then.
I have to say, it's as thrilling as any heist movie when you're watching it, even though it's a documentary and even though you know what happened, which is that they were never caught. But there were a lot of challenges to breaking into an FBI office at the time. I mean, it would be impossible now, but even then, they did an awful lot of preparation for this burglary to make it successful.
That's right. I mean, as you say, it's on the one hand extraordinary because they did do an enormous amount of preparation. On the other hand, it's so improbable. As you say, today it would be impossible to be able to break into an FBI office. Back then, there were these small FBI offices that existed. They were called resident agencies, and they had maybe four or five agents in them, and they were offices like that all over the country. And so, you know, there are these almost comedic moments where Bill Davidon says, you know, they scoped out the main office, FBI FBI office in downtown Philadelphia, and that was impossible because that was in a federal building that was guarded, you know, 24 hours a day. And he looked up in the phone book, literally in the yellow pages, FBI, and he found this small office that was in Media, which is really a kind of a sleepy suburb of Philadelphia, which was in a residential, it was an apartment building, this office, and so, you know, did not have an alarm system. So it was really a case of, you know, learning to pick locks and learning how to blend in and be extraordinarily careful, obviously, with the handling of the documents and what they did with them subsequently, and a tremendous amount of luck, too.
They called themselves the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI, and then once they successfully completed this burglary, this heist, they went home and they read the documents, always keeping gloves on, never revealing themselves in any way. Very, very careful.
Right.
And what they found in these documents was a lot of illegal activity on the part of the FBI, including in large part spying on citizens. Tell us about this kind of spying.
That's right. They did discover that immediately, and that was indeed, as we just talked about, that was what they were looking for. So again, you know, to the improbability of it, they were looking for it, and lo and behold, they found it immediately. And those are the documents that they sent to Betty Metzger at the Post, and that they published initially. Certainly, those initial documents revealed that there was spying going on. One of the documents, the very first document they found when they realized they had what they set out to find, was a document describing the fact that FBI agents should really, you know, step up their interrogation of anti-Vietnam War protesters, so as to really produce a sense of paranoia, so much so that people would believe there was an FBI agent behind every mailbox in the country. So those were kind of shocking documents. So that was the initial batch that they sent to Betty at the Post, and they kept sending. They kept on sifting through the documents. It took them some time to do so, every 10 days or so they would mail her these batches. And then, you know, again, the sort of long story, very short, the story does go on over several years. So initially, you know, it hits the headlines when the Washington Post publishes, creates a huge national furor. It's the first time that FBI documents have been seen in public. Hoover is very embarrassed. You know, it's the first time, really, that he's been publicly embarrassed in this way. There's massive investigation that starts. But then it fades from the headlines somewhat. Pentagon Papers happens a few months later. Daniel Ellsberg is then caught and he's put on trial. And then Watergate starts. And it's only a couple of years later when the story picks up again with Carl Stern, who was the NBC justice reporter. And he went to Congress, and a Senate staffer handed him a sheaf of papers one day. And they happened to be a sheaf of the media documents that they had stolen and by then were sort of, you know, widely circulated. One of those pieces of paper had the heading COINTELPRO, New Left, and Carl wondered what that meant. And through that process, he filed several FOIA requests. He actually had to sue. And in that process, the government finally released 50,000 pages to him. And now that was, you know, what we now know as the counterintelligence program, which was, encompassed so many different organizations in the country, but the sort of most notorious activities obviously concerned Martin Luther King, the Black Panthers, the New Left, as they were called. So we have, you know, incredible documentation now, but when you come to think of it, it came from this one document that they had stolen from the FBI office in Media.
The FBI did so many nefarious as well as illegal things. I mean, they were spying on Boy Scouts. They were spying
right.
on progressive college students, on Black students. And one of the ones that really kind of shook me was there was a couple somewhere, I think, in the Pacific Northwest that were activists, and they spread rumors that one of them was having an affair, and it actually broke up their marriage. I mean, basically, the taxpayer dollars were going to the FBI breaking up somebody's marriage for some kind of, like, I don't even know what you would call it, counterintelligence purposes.
Right, that's right. And that happened, you know, not infrequently. You know, there's also the, you know, very well-known infamous case of Jean Seberg, where they did a similar thing. They spread rumors that she was pregnant, very famous actress, and she became pregnant, and they spread rumors that the father of her baby was a Black Panther. You know, and so that baby was, you know, she miscarried and then, you know, several years later committed suicide.
So it's interesting that the Washington Post published this and the New York Times, who also got the documents, chose not to.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. This was a first. You know, it's kind of hard to believe now, but it was a first back then, certainly the first time that a journalist had ever received stolen government documents from someone outside of government. You know, these the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI are kind of unusual whistleblowers. Whistleblowers usually operate from inside the system. These guys, you know, literally broke in. So this was a first. Betty describes, you know, being shocked by the documents herself. They authenticated them. It turned out that was the easiest thing for them to do. And then the Attorney General, John Mitchell, you know, got on the phone with Catherine Graham and Ben Bradley at the Post and, you know, asked them not to publish because he said it was going to endanger national security. And fortunately, it was very clear very quickly that that was not the case. You know, they had the documents in front of them. And Betty speaks about the very important role that Ben Bradley played in persuading Catherine Graham to publish. They published against the advice of their legal counsel. She had to make that decision very quickly, too, within the space of 12 hours. When Betty handed in her story that day at 6 o'clock, she was told that the story, in all likelihood, would not run. But by 10 o'clock that night, Ben Bradley had managed to persuade Catherine Graham that she should do so. And we sort of surmised that, you know, that was the first time that Catherine Graham was asked by the Nixon administration to suppress a story. And, you know, perhaps as a result, her decisions on Watergate unfolded differently. You know, this perhaps gave her a little courage. She was, you know, she was relatively new at the paper at that time. But so, yes, in Hollywood terms, in all kinds of ways, I sort of view this as a prequel.
Yeah, exactly. Now, J. Edgar Hoover didn't resign, but the agency was shaken up. What was ultimately the effect on the FBI? Do you think it had a positive effect?
Yeah, interesting. You know, so no, you're right. He did not resign, which again still speaks to just how powerful he was. He died almost a year later, you know, after the burglary. And it was, you know, really thereafter that reforms were able to be put in place. You know, he did, as a direct result of the burglary, he closed down all of these small resident agencies. He closed all of them down across the country. Ostensibly, immediately, he closes down COINTELPRO. But in reality, he asked people to carry on these covert actions, but just not to call them COINTELPRO. But so, as I say, you know, it was really only once he died in 72, after 72, and once the Church Committee convenes, that was when Congress convened, you know, this investigation to look into the activities of all intelligence agencies, that really, once they issued their report, that put in place the first set of guidelines regulating the FBI's investigative powers. And there were reforms that took place, such as, you know, that's where we have the FISA Court, the Senate Intelligence Committee came out of the Church Committee hearings. The 10-year term limit for FBI directors came out of that as well. So, you know, never again would there be an FBI director who could hold that position for 50 years, which is what J. Edgar Hoover had done. He was just shy of 50 years when he died in office.
Right. And all of that went along until the Patriot Act, which undid a lot of those reforms.
That's right. That's right. There was a tremendous amount of rollback that has happened since September 11th. And, you know, I think that people, again, surmised that or thought that that was happening. But just as the Citizens Commission back in the day provided, you know, this empirical documentary evidence that this was going on, Edward Snowden did a very similar thing in June of 2013 when he released those documents. And reignited a debate that the Citizens Commission did back in 1971. They started this public debate that had never happened before. And Snowden, you know, certainly created that same kind of national debate, a debate I think that we hadn't really had since September 11th.
And once again, the kind of cycles of history and American history just go around and around. And, I mean, when you look back at this time and your movie really recreates a time that is so remote for most of us, or perhaps many of our listeners didn't experience that time at all. It's like the word un-American comes up. And I always think it's sort of odd. It's like, oh, it's un-American to spy on citizens. Well, at this point, we kind of think it is American to spy on citizens. That's what we've been doing. All the nefarious things that we've been doing since our country's founding, as well as the good things, seem to be pretty American. That word kind of doesn't get used so much anymore.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, people acknowledge, you're right. I mean, so it does date back. I mean, somebody in the film, an FBI agent makes the point that, yes, many presidents have used these kind of tactics. Most presidents have done them out in the open, ironically. It's really only under the Patriot Act that so much of this, you know, went on in secret, but now we know about it. Under Hoover, so much of it went on in secret, you know, and they revealed that. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think it sometimes takes people to do things that are courageous and controversial in order to stimulate conversations about, you know, the checks and balances that are kind of the lifeblood of democracy. And, you know, precisely as you say, these sort of oversight, you know, perhaps back in immediately after September 11th, it was understandable that we, you know, lost some of those constraints. But, you know, perhaps as a result of this debate, there are some people who are acknowledging, you know, from the president on down, that there needs to be perhaps a recalibration, certainly a conversation, and, you know, maybe government oversight is not as effective as it could be. The law is perhaps a little too all-encompassing. And that's not to say that the threats of terrorism aren't very real. But, you know, perhaps, you know, it's obviously a profoundly dangerous world, and we have to be vigilant about it. But we also have to be vigilant, perhaps, about those who are conducting the surveillance and the extent of that surveillance.
We're talking to Joanna Hamilton about the documentary 1971. Let's go back to the people who pulled off this burglary or heist. What was it like for them in the short run? I mean, they were watching the investigation, the search for them, and they were living their family lives and staying out of the way. And the FBI tried to find them and did not. What was it like for them at the time, and then in the years after, when it became clear that they weren't going to be found?
You know, as they describe it, it varied. I mean, I think, you know, in the film, there's a married couple who both participate in the break-in. They had three young children at the time, so they really did risk everything. So for them, I think the aftermath was very scary. They did spend many years looking over their shoulder. The younger members of the group, who were, you know, single and kind of starting life, describe it as a little less dramatic. Some of them, you know, say, you know, we did everything we could to take, you know, extraordinary precautions not to be caught. The FBI did launch this huge investigation, but they themselves say that, you know, they were helped by the fact that there were so many people who were politically active back then that they were able to sort of blend in. So they kind of lived underground, above ground. They didn't need to go underground because there were so many suspects in the investigation. You know, seven of the eight burglars ended up on the FBI's list of suspects. A couple of them were even visited by the FBI. And so there's this extraordinary mix of luck and incompetence in certain instances. I mean, the FBI did decide on day one of the investigation they had a particular person in mind who was responsible for this burglary, and it was somebody completely different who wasn't involved at all. But that sort of led them, it was kind of the, you know, red herring that led them down the wrong path ultimately. So yeah, there was you know, obviously many details. But yeah, long story very short is that they remained undetected and undiscovered for 43 years.
And did it affect the course of their lives? I mean, obviously they're eight different people, but what's your sense of that?
So they were quite remarkable. I mean, they really did go back. They blended in back into their normal lives, as we just talked about. And they went on. A couple of them remained politically active for some time and got involved in other actions. And then slowly, slowly, they all, you know, went about, you know, had these very productive professional careers, all of them. One of them, and it's interesting because she's not in the film, but she's very recently, she's the eighth burglar whom Betty and I try to find over the years. We couldn't find her, and none of the group were in touch with her anymore. She has since surfaced, and her trajectory was very different. She was very fearful of arrest. And she did go underground for many years. She lived under an assumed identity and cut off ties with her family, and then 20 years on regained her real identity again. But we still, you know, weren't able to find any trace of her until last year when she surfaced, and she actually called Bob, who's one of the members of the Citizens Commission. She called him up, and they are now, you know, back in touch. At the time, she was very shocked that they had the story was out, and I'm sorry we couldn't prepare her for it. But we are all now in touch with her. She talked to Betty and gave Betty an interview, and she is now the epilogue in Betty's paperback of the book that came out a couple of months ago. So she definitely had the most dramatic fallout, if you will, of all of them.
There was a ninth burglar who dropped out before the burglary, and that was a very dangerous person because there was a risk that that person could have turned them all in or turned on them.
That's right. That's right. And that guy, actually, that man actually came under very, very heavy FBI surveillance after the break-in, even though he ultimately wasn't involved. He came under 24-hour surveillance. He's all over the FBI's files, and there are 35,000 pages of the FBI's files that we have. 2 years on, he was actually the FBI came to talk to him, and he said nothing. So yes, it was a great danger back then, but they were all considered themselves very fortunate that he didn't hand them in.
Now, did the original Citizens Commission, did they keep the original documents? What happened to the originals?
No, they destroyed them. They destroyed the original documents.
So this movie is called 1971. It's a documentary. We're talking to Joanna Hamilton. Now, are you touring with Betty Metzger, the author of the book The Burglary?
Well, we've been very fortunate. I mean, the film has been touring at festivals, and so Betty is often with me. We've had really wonderful experiences, as are the Citizens Commission. I mean, several of them have been touring. And I do hope that when your viewers come to see the film that's opening this Friday at the CCA, one of them, Bob, will be present, actually, on Friday night for a Q&A in the theater. And Bob has, relatively speaking, hasn't really toured at all. So this is a rare opportunity to see him in person. But yes, there's been really both tremendous reaction to the book and the film, and just terrific opportunities to engage with the general public for people to both, you know, see the film and then get the book.
Joanna Hamilton's film is called 1971. Once again, it opens this Friday at the CCA. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.